Want to begin as we typically do with acknowledging that the place we gather, the land on which we gather, on which we live, is Treaty One land in the history of this continent. And there's a lot bundled into that little phrase, isn't there? Not the least of which is a long history of violence connected with race. And the ideologies of race connected with the ideologies often of religion, of the ways in which we conceive of and speak of and live into our notions of that which is not us. And so we don't have to look very far outside of our own front door. We don't have to look outside of any door. We can just look at a screen any given moment these days and see that without paying good attention to the confluence of those things, we can make a world that is resistant to what Martin Luther King Jr. called the arc of justice. And conversely, we can contribute to a world that moves toward, contributes to that arc of history bending toward justice. So when I say, when we gather on Treaty One land, those are all things that are sort of tumbling around inside of me when I do that. It's interesting to be a white person saying these things, a person of privilege, of by any global measure, wealth, a person so embedded in their own narrative that I'm usually only just barely conscious of that place of privilege. How shall I speak? How shall I think? How shall I act regarding the injustice that is not the way I experience the world? Oh, and I left out male. Huh, how about that? White privileged male. How shall I speak of the long injustice of men overpowering by violence women? How shall I speak of the injustice of white supremacy, of white ideology, and the way that it's visited over and over again on brown bodies? Well, those are big questions. Not actually what we're talking about directly this morning in the talky bit, but I wanted us to name them, because I think, at least for me, acknowledging my place in the world, that place of privilege, is where I need to start. And so in our breathing time together this morning, that's what I would invite us to. I would invite us to breathe this morning with those who feel unsafe today in mind. That's not meant to be a panacea. In fact, quite the opposite. My hope personally in breathing that way would be that for at least a few moments of this day, as for me personally, you know, a privileged white male, I would have those whose lives are not like mine very present in my thinking and my feeling, at least as much as I'm able in those circumstances and in those ways. If you're just joining us for the first time, you're not familiar with this community and its practices, we often begin this part of our times together with a few moments of breathing together. If that's not a practice you're familiar with, that's fine. Feel free to join as you feel comfortable. If it's not a practice you wish to engage in, then like everything else at the table, this is just an invitation and not an obligation. step into it if you think it would be helpful. Don't if you don't. So let's breathe together. And the invitation is to breathe for those who feel unsafe, or as the uprising in the US has often characterized it, those who have the sensation in their everyday lives of being unable to breathe. And then we'll go on from there. All right. So our practice this morning, we'll keep it very simple. We'll breathe in for a count of three through our noses, cradle our breath deeply in the core of our body for a count of three, breathe out for a count of three if you count slow, six if you count fast, empty right out. And we'll do three cycles of that, and then we will carry on. Let's breathe together. Peace. As a community committed to exploring belief, I think we need to do whatever we can to make as generous a space as possible for that exploration. That kind of space making starts inside of each of us in the ways that we make room for ourselves to explore. Even if, and this is not an unusual story, I think, even if we've sometimes spent our whole lives being taught that that kind of exploration is a dangerous thing to do and to be avoided. One of my favorite ways to explore what I believe is to reconsider familiar stories, and especially stories that were used, at least in my experience, primarily to reinforce traditional or already familiar dogma. So, because the Christian tradition is my tradition of origin, those are the stories that are both the hardest for me to hear in a new way, in an exploratory way, and they tend to be the most satisfying to explore when I do the necessary work to have that experience. So I know that's not everyone's story, but because I'm the one talking at the moment, and because that is my tradition of origin, that's where I'm going to start. So this morning, what I'm going to do is go exploring inside a perhaps familiar biblical story, but in a way that doesn't use the story to reinforce traditional beliefs. As we've discussed before, the religious tradition that this kind of practice might be closer to is the one that the story comes from. It's a Jewish story. And the Jewish tradition of Midrash, which invites us, even encourages us, to take ancient stories and sit them next to contemporary situations in order to have the story read us, to have it reveal things to us about our circumstances that might release ancient, enduring wisdom into the present. And I realize we could take exception with the idea that this is a Jewish story, given that it comes from Luke, who is writing for not Jews, for everyone in the world that's not from that tradition. But that is still the context, and I think the Jewish tradition of coming to these stories in this way is a rich one, regardless of which stories we bring it to. And the idea that coming to an ancient story with a certain attitude or perspective that might release its enduring wisdom into the world, to me, that feels like a hopeful idea. We could always use some enduring wisdom, and God knows right now that's easy to see that that's the case. So, with some hope in that regard, I'm going to just dive in. First of all, a recap of the story as we may be familiar with it if we grew up in and around traditional Christian teaching. And maybe recap just in case we're not as familiar with it as we think we are. So, the story would typically be known as the Emmaus Road story. The content of the story is that it takes place 3 days after Jesus has been executed by the Romans, and the body has disappeared, and it's all very confusing. In this story, there are two guys, more about them shortly, but they're walking from Jerusalem to a village called Emmaus, which is a few miles outside of the city, and they are discussing current events. And as they're walking along having this conversation, suddenly Jesus shows up and walks with them, but they don't recognize him. And even when Jesus takes the time to sort of explain what's going on in light of history and Hebrew prophecy and so on, they still don't recognize him. And then they get to a point in their walk where they're just outside of this village that they're headed for, and Jesus looks like he's going to keep on going, and they say, "Listen, it's a long ways to the next village, and it's late. Why don't you stay with us?" And they offer him supper, and he agrees and goes with them into the village. When they sit down and break out whatever food they have, and they go to share it, that's when they recognize who's with them, and then poof, he disappears. And they get right up and they hike back to Jerusalem to tell the folks there what they've experienced. So that's basically what the text tells us. That's the shape of the story that has survived transmission and translation and interpretation and revision and made it into our hands in, the 21st century West. Now, the way that I grew up around that story and the way that it got handled was primarily as sort of a proof story. And what it was supposed to prove as part of a bundle of these kinds of stories was to prove the literal bodily resurrection of Jesus. It was one of a collection of stories that were used to send the message, you can be sure of this particular belief, which strikes me as a bit of an odd application given the rather spectral behavior of the Jesus character in this story with all the magic appearances and disappearances. I'm not going to go down that path this morning. There's plenty there to explore. But that's not where we're headed. In fact, I am going to suggest this morning that this is, instead of being a you can be sure story, I think this can be read as primarily a what's going on story. At least that's how it reads to me, especially when we take it from the vantage point of the two main characters in the story, which are the two travelers. Now, it's interesting to me that we have no idea who these two guys are. They're not identified in the story. Luke is the only one of the people who write the story of Jesus' life that tells us this particular story, and he doesn't spend much time on those details. We do know that they're not part of Jesus' sort of inner circle. And we know that because later in the story, when they run back to Jerusalem, it's that inner circle that they actually report to. So they're not marquee players. They're not big stars. They're just ordinary folks. And we already know from the story that they can't get their heads around what's going on, but to make matters more interesting, they are also en route to a place that is relatively unknown. We don't know anything historically about the village of Emmaus. There's no remnant, there's no, like, we don't know what that village was or where it was in any particular way. So the two main characters in the story are ordinary people. They are traveling to somewhere insignificant, and they are in a deep fog of confusion because of current events. So far, they sound like I feel some days. And it's from that point of view that I want to explore the story. So, how might we characterize what these two travelers are going through? Well, one way to think about their experience is as a liminal one. And we've talked about this idea before. The word itself, liminal, comes from surprise, the Latin, from a word that means threshold. So if you were walking from one room into another and you were standing right in that space in between the two, especially in a more traditional or an older construction that used more stone, there'd be this wide band of stone that went right through that space. You could stand on it, and that space is the liminal one. That's the threshold, the space where you're not in this room and you're not in that room. And so that's an idea now, primarily, the idea of liminality and what kinds of experiences we might use that way. We also use that language for ritual transitions. When you're moving from child to adult, let's say in a ritual way, when you're in that in-between moment, that's a liminal space. When we're having a liminal experience, we're standing at the threshold between our previous way of structuring our identity or our time or our community and some new way. Those are liminal experiences. So in experiences like that, things like continuity of tradition might become uncertain. Future outcomes that we once took for granted may get thrown into doubt. Any of this sounding familiar to anybody out there? Well, anyway, these travelers in this story are on a threshold between a past that they thought they knew and a future that they can't hopefully look forward to. They're stuck. They're so deeply occupied with their discussion of what has been lost, and these are real losses, mind you. But they're so deeply occupied with their discussion of what's been lost and what the implications of that might be that they can't open their imaginations to the future. What significantly shifts all of that in this story is when they become present to the present. They show up in the moment. Now, how does that happen inside of the story? Well, here's one of the things that I love about ancient wisdom of all sorts. If we let it, it can still help us know how to live under whatever circumstances we find ourselves in. The definition of wisdom, as we find it in the ancient Hebrew texts, especially wisdom literature as a category, could be understood as skill for living. And that's something that we all need all the time, no matter what our worldview or system of belief might be. And this story has that. It has that characteristic about it. It's full of wisdom. It has a very, and wisdom is a very hands-on kind of thing. It's not vague. It sort of refuses to stay in the realm of the theoretical. This story has some of those characteristics about it. It has a very tangible, doable aspect in which the travelers, in the course of having this liminal experience, and so these things intersect, the liminality and the practicality. That's interesting in itself. But in the course of having this liminal experience, these guys do a few things, really kind of actual things that we can all do to help us get unstuck and moving toward hope again, whether we claim to have any particular faith or belief system that we're consciously committed to or nothing like that at all in our lives. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to talk about and just observe what some of the things are that these guys do over the course of this journey that they're on that I think reorient their world as regards hope in particular. So the first thing we see the travelers doing is becoming present to the present moment by feeling their losses and the emotions that come with them. When Luke describes the emotional state of these travelers, he calls them downcast. These guys are sad, they're confused, they're adrift, they are experiencing grief and disorientation. And as the storyteller would have it, they're not trying to hide it. They are, the way Luke characterizes them, visibly sad. They're feeling the feelings. This is interesting because when it comes to not getting stuck in a liminal space, an in-between space, this actually matters a lot. Our feelings, our emotions, come from our bodies. We interpret them with our brains. We make something of them with our brains, but their source, their deepest, sort of most primal source, is our biological selves. So if we refuse to feel those emotions, they get stuck. And they get stuck in us, and we get stuck right along with them. And so until we feel the feelings, we're going to struggle to make room for whatever feeling comes next. And we can end up sort of, not permanently liminal, but extendedly liminal. I don't think that worked grammatically, but anyway, there's the idea. So, despite how lost these guys might seem, they're actually off to a pretty good start when it comes to finding their way back to hope, just by being willing to feel the feelings that go with the experiences that they're having. And the second thing that they do that's really sort of practical, that helps them move from liminality toward hope, is that they don't isolate with their feelings. They talk with one another about them. And that's the way the story gets told. They're walking along, they're talking with one another about these deep feelings that they're having. And sometimes when I think about these two guys having this experience, and I try to imagine it in the 21st century, which is an exercise that I find helpful when I'm coming to stories and I want to see them in a different way, I ask myself, what would the story look like if it was here and now? And when I think about this story that way, I imagine one of them texting the other, and the text is like, "Hey, road trip." And the other guy's like, "Bleep, yeah." So maybe that's just a stereotypical guy imagination moment. But for many of us, there is nothing like some time traveling together to really get stuff out in the open. And these guys are doing that. They're traveling along together and having this conversation. And bonus points to these guys for doing it in a way that's, carbon neutral. The point, of course, is that they are talking about the things that had them feeling stuck. They're having that conversation. Third thing that they do is that they welcome a fresh perspective. I think this is one of the most intriguing parts of this story. These guys are walking along. They're mulling over the crazy events of the past days. They're wondering what's going to happen next. They're wondering where to go from here. And as they're journeying along, someone else joins them. It's someone they don't know. And this is important. And I get that lots of us have been taught to read this story backwards, that we've been taught to kind of go to the last chapters first, decide how we want to interpret those chapters, and then go back and see what the middle ones mean. What I wrote down in my notes is, stop it. Don't do that. And the reason that I think that that's important to not do that is that if we want to travel with the travelers, if we want to have the stories read us and our circumstances and our lives, if we want ancient wisdom to endure in an ongoing way in the world in which we live, we have to travel with the travelers. And that means we have to try to be in the story the way that they were, which means we have to be in the story the way that we're in our story, which means we're in a story that we don't know the ending of. We don't know how this is going to end, and neither do they. So when the Jesus character shows up and starts telling these guys this whole different way to understand what's going on around them, because that's what he does as Luke tells the story. He kind of goes, oh, here's a way to think about this in light of history and in light of Hebrew prophecy. And he kind of lays out this whole other ideological framework for the experience that they're having. As far as they know, that perspective is coming from a total stranger. It's not coming from the Jesus that they know. It's coming from someone they don't know, someone they don't recognize, someone they don't have a trust history with. And they welcome that perspective anyway. That's interesting. And I feel like if I really sink into the story, I can almost see their faces and their minds shifting and changing as they listen to this new perspective. Hearing a new perspective, at least in my experience, is really hard. I mean, we can ping, like we can have it kind of come into our space and bounce out and be gone. That's not very hard. That's what happens, in a sidebar online. That's so easy to dismiss. Click, no more new perspective. But to hear it, to entertain it, to let it rattle around inside of us, even when the rattling makes us uncomfortable, which it is almost bound to do, that's hard. And the characters in this story, the travelers in this story, do that. They welcome this new perspective. And as you kind of go through the story, you can watch the impact of that new perspective sort of filtering down into the way that they see the world and what they see is present in the world. The fourth thing that they do is they get their eyes off themselves and onto the needs of someone else. And that's what happens in the story when they come to this intersection where they're going off. I always imagine them turning right. I have no idea why. I'm right-handed, I suppose. Just my bias showing that they're going off to Emmaus and Jesus is, going to keep going to some other place in the story. And right at that intersection is where it feels to me like this really significant action takes place, where they were like, great walking with you, great talking with you. Thanks for the ideas. Those are interesting. You should probably keep going now because your ideas made us, go, and we're just going to hang together and go, with the people we know, and something good filters down. We'll get back to you. Do we have your number? Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Great to meet you. See you online. No, it happens. They get their heads out of themselves right in this moment, and they invite the stranger to share what they have to offer. And it's not like they have a lot to offer. That's not the point. The point is not the magnitude of the care. The point is the care. And so it feels like in that moment where they're like, here's what we got. Here, we'll share it with you. We can see that your need is like our need. You've been walking all day too. You've been going through this crazy stuff too. So, are you feeling this? Are you hungry? Are you tired? Are you you disconcerted? Do you want to just sit with some people for a bit? Like, what do you need? Do you need the things we need? We'll share what we got. It's not a lot, but yeah, why don't you come with us? And it feels like right in that process somehow, in the dynamic of that's when their upside down world doesn't suddenly sort of snap upright, although the story has a bit of that characteristic because like lots of these stories, it compresses huge movements in human people into really, sitcom length sort of and less sort of length. But it feels like there's something that happens there where their world starts to shift. And to me, that's a really beautiful part of the story. And I would say that that's the part of the story where they begin to become present to the present as regards hope. They begin to realize that the center of their hope has been present in this story all the way along. It's not suddenly a new presence. It's an ongoing presence. And that is world altering. That's perspective altering. Now, I don't know if you've ever consciously had the experience of being in some kind of pain, physical, emotional, spiritual, but where you knew it, you knew you were hurting. And you found yourself involved in doing something caring for another person, and then realized that while you were doing it, you didn't notice your own pain for quite a while. Now, there's all kinds of reasons why that happens. But in the most basic practical terms, getting our eyes off ourselves and onto someone else's needs, when it comes to getting unstuck from liminality and reorienting ourselves toward hope, this is one of the things that we can do that just plain flat out often works. It's just pragmatic in that way, as much as it's also mysterious and kind of intriguing. And so that to me, that feels like in a lot of ways the hinge of the story. And then they do this other thing that we can all do. They take this refreshed perspective, this moment of realization that hope is present, even in this disconcerting, where are we going story that they're in, and they carry it to others that are also struggling. They get up right then and there in the story and they leg it back to Jerusalem. I don't know if you've ever walked 14 miles, but that's a pretty good day of walking. And I've walked through some of the geography where this story likely took place, and not a lot of distractions. It's a pretty bleak landscape. But they get up and they just head back to Jerusalem because they feel like this is not a thing to keep to yourself. When you've got some hope percolating and you have some sense that a perspective that you hadn't entertained before is part of that, or sharing what you have is part of that. That's not a thing to keep to yourself. And we could extrapolate, and it might be a too generous extrapolation, but we could extrapolate some of these ideas into things like the violence that we've been feeling more conscious of here this morning, and we might be feeling more conscious of ongoing because of what's going on around us. In many ways, the core of the injustices that we are seeing made visible in this moment of history, in this part of the world, those are not new injustices. Their visibility, their unique illustration, the intersection at which they are being revealed, those things are unique. That's a unique confluence. The injustice is not unique. And neither is the hope in the midst of those kind of circumstances. I know it's almost a trope already because it's so frequently visited, but I can't listen to Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, never mind watch it, without being reminded in a fresh way that these are ancient themes. These are ancient issues. And that somehow, in King, in any case, there was an African American voice that had hope. And they had that hope because they were familiar with an ancient story that was full of enduring wisdom and that brought that perspective of one day all people together as equals into the narrative of history. And they took that perspective and shared it with the world. Costly business in this particular instance. This is not trite, throwaway stuff, but it is powerful. In the Luke story, it would be fair to say that those two travelers going back to Jerusalem with this new perspective and renewed hope had a bit of a ripple effect. And in fact, the renewed hope of that whole community had a kind of ripple effect that we can still see and feel today. It's that same intersection that King, as a person who looked at the world through the lens of the Christian tradition and its stories, as well as the Hebrew tradition and its stories, it's that same ripple that would have motivated him to say, I have a dream of equality for all. That does not mean that that is the only set of stories, the only repository of ancient wisdom that could stir this kind of hope, that could help us step out of a liminal space and into a space of renewed hope. But it is one set of stories that, if we let it, I think can contribute to that. The common thread in all of this is that the travelers had to walk away from something they thought they knew before they could see it in a new way. Just no shortcut on that one. And when they did walk away from something that they thought they knew, and they did have the experience of seeing the world around them from a fresh perspective, one brought to them by a stranger, that's when they found out that they could look forward to the future with a renewed sense of hope and joy. There's one other thing that this reading of the story reminds me about, and that is that we don't have to wait until we know something to be changed by it. thank goodness we can learn as we go. We can be changed as we travel. This new perspective is not a destination. It's an experience. It's more like watching the landscape unfold outside the car window as we travel than it is like stepping out of the airplane in a different geography and climate and culture than the one we stepped into the airplane on. We can be changed as we travel. Change, I think it's also safe to say, is never easy, but it's also not unapproachable, and it doesn't need to be magical. We can travel with good courage and with hope, my friends. And I hope that this is a week in which we can do that. There is hope to be found, even when we find ourselves feeling downcast or feeling like we're on the road to who knows where in the company of those whose way of looking at the world is different than ours. Peace to you all. It's been good to be together. Onward.